The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order state and local government oversight, reform, technology, and elections. The first bill on the agenda is House File 545, Representative Champion. Representative Champion, I am told that House File 545, should it pass, and this will be my motion, will then be sent to Public Safety, Policy, and Oversight. So the motion will be to pass House File 545. And be re-referred to Public Safety, Policy, and Oversight. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank you for, first of all, for taking out the time to listen to this wonderful piece of legislation that I might say that is before you. Mr. Chair, there is a delete everything amendment that I would ask to be moved now.
Is this the DE1?
Yes, sir.
I'll move the DE1, but before we put it on, why don't you explain what it does?
The DE1, in Section 1, what it does is that it states that the Secretary of State shall develop an accurate and complete information in a single publication that will be available, well, that talks about voting rights, and particularly for people who have been discharged with or convicted of a crime, and this publication must be made available to folks electronically so that it's easily accessed by all interested parties. In Section 2, what it does is that it talks about the notice of restoration of one's right to vote. If you look in Subdivision 1 of Section 2, it talks about a local correctional facility will designate a person who will provide the notice and application required under this section to inmates who have been restored to civil rights. Just so that most people know, which we will talk a little bit about in Subdivision 2, is that it's possible for a person to go to jail or to prison, execute all their time, they don't have to do any probation or anything afterwards, and once they are released, their civil rights have been restored. Under Subdivision 2 of Section 2, it just creates a notice of restoration of civil rights and that a voter registration application must be provided, and you see one under Subdivision 2-1 that person who's identified at the correctional facilities will tell the person to, the probation officer will tell the person, and we are asking for there to be, and for that notice to be done in a particular form, and that's under Subdivision 3. And you will see in Subdivision 3, it just really talks about the person being discharged, and that means that the civil rights have been restored, and that this includes their right to vote in Minnesota. And it just talks about some other things. And the reason why we believe that's important is so that it creates some uniformity, so that this notice, as articulated in this legislation, provides people or individuals with the information that they need in order to know that their civil rights have been restored. And finally, also in Subdivision 4, you will see that failure to provide notice does not prevent the restoration of a person's or of an inmate's civil rights being restored upon discharge. And finally, in Section 3, this is just to say that at the time, if a person is going to plead guilty or is found guilty of a felony level offense, that the court, while it's telling the felon at that particular time that their right to vote has been taken away and that they cannot vote until their civil rights have been restored. And that's what the DE-1 does.
Members, and for people who have just come in, Representative Champion has just described the DE-1 amendment. I have moved the amendment, but we haven't voted on it. So out of courtesy to the author, we'll put the DE-1 on the bill. So all those in favor of the DE-1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So we will be working off the DE-1 amendment. Representative Champion, you have someone who wishes to testify?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Mr. Andre Corbett. He will tell you a little about himself, and he's going to testify as to why this legislation is important. And just so that you all will also know that the Senate, this is the DE1 that you've just adopted, puts the bill in shape consistent with the Senate bill that has already gone past local governments and the Judiciary Committee, and is now on the General Register on the Senate side.
Representative Champion, before we do that, so is this the DE1 amendment? Is it identical now to the Senate file?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and then please identify yourself for the record.
Andre Corbett. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The reason why this bill is so important for me is because I would have been directly affected by a criminal background. When I was 19 years old, just made a stupid mistake and going through some hard times in life and ended up committing a robbery. Because of the one robbery that I did do, I was ultimately charged with two other ones that I didn't do. I pled guilty on the one that I did and went to a jury trial and lost on the other two that I did not do. During that whole process and that time when I signed a plea agreement, I never knew that my right to vote and my civil rights would be taken away. Upon release from prison, it still never, nobody informed me about what my rights were, about when I would be able to vote, about what civil rights were taken away from me. And I did not recognize that until after I got discharged from parole. I got a letter in the mail stating that all of my civil rights, including the right to vote and hold public office, will be restored. Currently, I'm working at Goodwill East Assistance doing job placement for their reentry program, and I've been working with ex-offenders probably 4 months after I've gotten out. And over the past 3 years, I've worked with well over 300 individuals with felony criminal convictions. And I'm always talking to those individuals about what their rights are, about when they can and can't vote, because a lot of it is not known. One of the problems as well is individuals who are on probation or parole at the time of discharge. You do have a final meeting with the probation or parole officer. However, the letter doesn't come in the mail. A lot of individuals are really transient who have different addresses, so they don't always get that letter. And it would have been nice on my last meeting with my parole officer, you know, that if there was something to inform me that I can vote again, because a lot of individuals do not get that letter in the mail. At the time of when I took the plea agreement, it never was informed to me that certain civil rights will be taken away. And when I read through the plea agreement and I read everything thoroughly, it still never was explained, and it never was explained in any of the language in the plea agreement. And it's just very important for individuals to know, once they are released from prison, once they are discharged from probation or parole, that they can vote. Because, you know, within a country, so many states do things differently, and there's no uniform way for individuals to know. So that's why I'm fully in support, not only on my behalf, but on behalf of Goodwill East Assistance, as well as every individual with a criminal record, felony conviction in Minnesota. Thank you.
Members, any questions to Mr. Garvey? Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Sir, you said you got a letter that outlined all of your rights and how you could go about discharging the felony conviction. Is that right?
Yes.
Mr. Corbett?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
And you were represented by counsel, I take it, when you entered into this plea agreement on your upon your felony conviction?
Mr. Corbett.
Yes, I was.
And
Representative Emmer.
Then when you have this kind of exit interview as you're being discharged from the correctional facility, you have another meeting. Is it with a parole officer, or is it with someone in the Correctional Facilities Administration? Who actually conducts that meeting?
Mr. Carbis. I had one final meeting with my parole officer about 2 weeks before I was discharged from parole. In that meeting, it never was explained to me that when I would be eligible to vote. The letter that I did receive in the mail, I did receive that, but I've been fortunate enough to be at the same place of residence for over 3 years. Individuals that I work with coming out of prison, finding housing is very difficult, so a lot of individuals are staying with family members and float from house to house, from address to address. So the final address that the probation or parole officer may have may not be the exact address where they receive a mail at, so that letter does not ultimately get to every individual.
Mr. Chair.
Well, sir, that wasn't exactly my question, but that's helpful. Your probationary period was for how long?
Mr. Corbett, my complete sentence was 74 months. I spent 3.5 years in prison and 2.5 years on parole.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Corbett, so during the 2.5 years on parole, you had to check in, you had a parole officer that you were assigned to that you had to check in with on a regular basis?
Mr. Corbett?
That is correct.
Mr. Chair, checked in on a regular basis. How often do you see the parole officer during that period? Is it monthly? Is it every 6 months? What is that?
Mr. Corbett?
For my own case, I've only seen my parole officer 3 times in the 2.5 years I was on parole.
Okay. And
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Corbett, what's your understanding of what would happen if you didn't comply with your post-release parole?
Mr. Corbett?
Mr. Chair, it was my understanding that if I didn't meet certain conditions of my parole, I would either be restructured and put on maybe house arrest, or if any serious cases was to happen, I would be ultimately returned to prison.
All right.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If your parole officer, you had to keep in touch with your parole officer, Mr. Corbett, my understanding is you have to provide your parole officer with contact information in case they need to get a hold of you. Isn't that the case?
Corbett.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Yeah, Representative Emmer, let's try to focus on the bill as amended if we could. I don't know where this line of questioning is going, but if we can focus on this.
I'm just trying to get an understanding because, Mr. Chair, my understanding from my Representative Champion is that this went to civil law, but we're talking about issues that have to do with attorney-client relationships when you're talking about the plea agreement. The witness is telling us that he didn't know, he should have been told. That's not within our, actually, I don't know that.
Well, Representative Emmer, if you would just expedite your questioning to the point.
I'd ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested on the bill as amended, so there will be a roll call at that point. Representative Champion.
Just for clarity, there are two things here. One is, this bill is not to talk about attorney-client privilege. No one is remotely talking about attorney-client privilege. What it does speak to is once a judge is getting ready to announce or proclaim what a person's sentence is, this bill only says that we would like, as a part of what the judge says, and there's a litany of things that the judge says, will say, is that one of the things that the judge will say is a felony-level offense to say that you know that your right to vote has been suspended and you cannot vote. That is to make sure, number one, that there's no confusion about the person not voting and what that means. And also, I think it's important to note that this particular legislation is not about once a person is released from prison and they still have a parole officer or any of that. Once they are discharged off probation, parole, they're off paper. Under the current law, once they're off paper, they can vote. And all we're saying is that we want there to be a uniform sense of notification around that person's right to vote.
Representative Champion, what position has the Secretary of State's office taken on this? Since in the Delete Everything Amendment, you're requesting them to notify here.
Yes. The Secretary of State's office are okay and now feel great about the Delete Everything Amendment. And, in fact, Beth Fraser is here from the Secretary of State's office and that this bill
right.
will not
I
have
would,
any
I would prefer great and okay. It's a little vague.
Okay.
If the Secretary of State's office could come up and in reference to the DE-1 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. We are supportive of this legislation and of the as it is rewritten in the DE-1 amendment. We really support any legislation that helps inform voters of their rights and informs those who are not eligible that they are not eligible to vote. We actually believe that this legislation is very important, especially the piece related to the courts telling people that they no longer have the right to vote until they finish their sentence. We believe that this would make it easier to prosecute people who do vote when they are not eligible, because then it would be clear that they had been told. And that it would prevent people from making a mistake and believing that they are eligible and voting when they're not.
Members, any questions to the Secretary of State's office before I start working on the list? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fraser, how many felons improperly voted in the last election?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we have reason to believe that 61 felons voted in the 08 election, and I believe, 70 voted in the 04 election.
Representative Emmer.
Ms. Fraser, since your administration is in office, I'd like to stick with the 08. When you say you have reason to know, how do you, or how does Secretary of State Ritchie's administration have reason to know?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we've worked with the Department of Corrections to look at the individuals who voted and individuals who are currently under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Corrections, and have identified 61 people who we believe are serving felony sentences, who it appears have voted. We have contacted the appropriate county attorneys, and they are conducting investigations, and some of them are pursuing prosecution.
Ms. Fraser, have you personally talked to any of these people?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fraser, on Section 1, it talks about the duties and the information, and that's what the Secretary of State would be responsible for. Is there anything done at this point that is a complete and accurate information has provided regarding the voting rights?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, we did put together a flyer prior to the last election about voting rights if you've been convicted of a felony and when they're restored, but we didn't provide it to all of these different entities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppe.
And if this legislation does not go through, would it be possible for you to take this section and be able to do that?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, we could definitely do that.
Members, I want to remind everyone we're under roll call. So if members are going to drift away for whatever purpose, I would hope they would tell us where you are. So when we get to the roll call, we can get you. So we are under roll call on this bill. Representative Gutwell, do you want a question to Secretary of State or the... Any further questions to Secretary of State's office? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, I do have someone also here from the Department of Corrections.
Representative Champion, I've got one more member. Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Champion. I'm a little curious about this bill because, as I understand it, this information is already made available to a felon upon discharge.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Champion,
this information is not presented to a felon in a uniformed way. Even when I was out politicking, for lack of a better word, or campaigning, so many people said that they didn't know that they, in fact, had the right to vote. They were talking about and sharing anecdotal stories around the fact that they believed that once they received the felony, that they were no longer able to vote. And that was a concern to me because we as a society are always looking for more ways to engage people so that they understand their rights and that they're engaged positively. And so right now, this is not happening in a uniform way, and we believe that this legislation or this bill is important.
Representative Gullo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, and members of the committee, we have a society, a legal system based on ignorance is no defense. Felons and people involved in our criminal justice system have a great deal of interaction with legal counsel. They are advised constantly about their rights, about the options in front of them. I would point you, by the way, to Section 609.165, Restoration of Civil Rights, Possession of Firearms, under which this bill would go. Subdivision 1, Restoration, says, and I'm going to only quote it in part for the sake of brevity here, but it indicates that such discharge shall restore the person to all civil rights and full citizenship with full right to vote and hold office, the same as if such conviction had not taken place, and the order of discharge shall so provide. The order of discharge that these people receive is to indicate to them that they are restored to the right to vote. So again, my question to you, Representative Champion, is why are we doing this extra step? Because under your rationale, we should be doing this for lots of people. Lots of people who apparently are ignorant of their right to vote. There's really a whole list of rights to which these people are being restored, so we really should extend this to a longer list so that they're really abundantly aware of all their rights. They're all important.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Champion.
Representative, Representative, you actually have helped me in so many ways by indicating the importance of us making sure that people are informed and that they're informed in a real way, because I believe that you agree with me that you want everyone to be informed and to exercise their right to live, work, and vote as a citizen of our wonderful United States. And so with that, I believe in empowerment. You believe in empowerment. That means providing people with the information that they need in a uniform way. When we think in terms of every person's place of space, then there's a number of different considerations around literacy, around what someone says, if someone says civil rights, what does that mean? Most felons don't always go to the statutes to look up Minnesota Statute 609. I think that it is just our duty as informed ones to just make sure that people really truly understand what their rights are, and to also make sure that election judges know what felon rights are, and just so that it deletes confusion in the marketplace. And so this is not putting an extra burden on anyone. It is extending ourselves in a way in order to make sure that this good policy is implemented in a uniform way. Lastly, I would say when we think in terms of lien holders, there's a notice requirement, there's specific language that must be provided even for contractors when they're thinking in terms of being able to place a lien on someone. Why? That uniform language makes sure that it's in a conspicuous way and that people truly understand it. And we're just asking for uniformity to be the order of the day.
All right. Members, we do have session at 10:30, and we have a full agenda. Representative Govel.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, we are here on the Government Ops Committee to look at government operations in relation to these kinds of things. There is already notice given. The government already gives notice in the discharge order. And I don't assume that felons or anybody coming out of jail is necessarily ignorant. I assume that, like the rest of us in society, they are capable of accessing the information given to them. I'm also concerned that with a $5 billion deficit, we're talking about adding another layer on a very specific set of rights when, in fact, it's already given to them. This information is provided to people leaving custody. I mean, when they are discharged, it is given to them. It's in state law already. I don't think we need this extra layer.
Right, Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, on Section 3, quick question. Would failure to provide this notification nullify a plea agreement?
Representative Champion.
No. And Mr. Chair and Representative, the answer to your question is no. And I want to make sure that we're very clear about something. This language here has nothing to do with a plea agreement, so I'm not quite sure why we're off on a tangent talking about a plea agreement. The information that is articulated in Subdivision 3 is language that we want to be a part of discharge papers that is provided to a felon. It is not a part of any plea agreement. So I'm not quite sure why we're off on this tangent thinking that Subdivision 3 is around a plea agreement. Once a person has served their time, they're being discharged from probation, we want, as a part of the information that is put forward, this uniform language so that an individual will know that their civil rights have been restored and that they may vote. That's all it is.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, excuse me for believing that words actually mean things.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me for actually believing that words mean things. I'm reading Section 3. It is very specific to a plea agreement. It's prior to the court accepting a plea agreement. Your testifier testified to not knowing prior to a plea agreement that he would lose his civil rights, including the right to vote. I don't know how else you can read Section 3, Representative Champion. So I'm
Representative Champion. Mr. Chair. Representative Diskin, I was looking at Subdivision 3, so if you're looking at Section 3, Section 3, from our vantage point, is merely prior to a person accepting a plea agreement or anything that the court must notify. That is not in the plea agreement. It can be stated orally, as the court does on a regular basis right now. They will say from the bench, the judge will say from the bench, that here are things you can do. You cannot for an example, possess, own a firearm. You cannot vote. You cannot do a number of things. So it doesn't necessarily have to be in the plea agreement, but we want it communicated to a person who is either entering a plea of guilty or have been adjudicated guilty.
All right, let's end Champion. Before we bring up the next person, is there anyone here wishes to testify against the bill as amended? No one wishes to testify against it. Red Sim Chan, you have one more witness?
Is that it? Yes,
one
we
more
do
testifier?
Have a representative here from the Department of Corrections.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Barbara Cox from the Department of Corrections. I'm just here to say that the department does not oppose the bill. We have three probation systems and supervised release in Minnesota, and over the years we have had numerous members of the legislature contact us about the different notification of offenders' voting rights. So this is something that we've gotten a lot of questions about. As far as the responsibilities put on the Department of Corrections, this we have no objection to them, and as far as the facilities are concerned, it basically formalizes a process that we have in place.
All right, so Ms. Cox, you are supportive, neutral, or against one of the three?
We're neutral.
Neutral. All right. Questions? No questions. All right. Thank you. Any further discussion to House File 545 as amended? There has been a roll call. All right. Clerk will take the roll.
Anderson?
No.
Diston?
No.
Emmer?
No.
Cutwall?
No.
Tilkey?
Aye.
Weinstein?
Yes.
Hahn?
Yes.
Taylor? Aye. Kitzmeyer? No. Lanning? Yes. Markport? Morrow? Yes. Nelson? Yes. Hoppe? No. Sanders? Simon? Aye. Turner? Winkler? Aye. Kirkland? No.
The motion on the bill was to send it to public safety, policy, and oversight. There being 9 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill, if amended, will be sent to the committee. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Next bill on the agenda is Representative Wilson. Representative Welty, House File 622, as you're about to amend it, I believe it would go to the General Register. Without the amendment, it would go to Finance. So I'm going to move that House File 622, in anticipation of the amendment going on, be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. If the amendment doesn't go on, then I'll withdraw that motion and we'll send it somewhere else. So that's the motion. Then we might as well move to the A09-0160 amendment, and I will move the amendment, but before we put it on, why don't you explain the amendment, because it's dramatically different than the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A09-0160 amendment essentially takes out or deletes all of the language that was related to the grant program of the Lifesaver program. What the A09-0160 amendment does is it establishes a Lifesaver advisory task force, and the Lifesaver program is a program that is implemented to track any individuals that may, for instance, have autism, Down syndrome, Alzheimer's disease, vulnerable citizens, and others with a mental impairment that may cause them to wander. It's a voluntary program that's being implemented in some of our counties throughout the state of Minnesota. Other states are implementing it and other municipalities throughout the country. The Lifesaver Advisory Task Force, as outlined in the amendment, it is composed of 5 members. One member experienced in the area of mental impairment, one member experienced in the area of law enforcement, and one member experienced in the development of Lifesaver or similar programs. We also made sure that this task force is totally voluntary. Members serve without compensation, and they also serve at the pleasure of the commissioner. It's a voluntary task force, and we have put in the language that it will expire June 30th of 2013, so we would like the task force to serve for 4 years and then sunset. Subdivision 3, the last subdivision of the bill, requires that the commissioner of public safety report to the House of Representatives and the committee's having jurisdiction over public safety by 2012 on the effectiveness of the Lifesaver program.
Our members, there's a memo in your packet dealing with the areas of the delete everything amendment that are within the purview of the committee. If there isn't any further discussion, let's put the amendment on out of courtesy to the author. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Resident Welty, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've already pointed out we will take them. I have a short DVD, a testifier, just to kind of give you a background on this bill, but essentially House File 622 establishes the voluntary task force. The Minnesota State Patrol has agreed to be the convener of the task force, and besides that, the Lifesaver programs have been implemented throughout states and local units of government throughout the country. The technology is proven and very effective. Upon implementation of the program, lives will be saved. Fewer families will grieve over the death of a child, parent, or grandparent. Time spent searching for missing individuals will be greatly reduced, and emergency personnel resources and dollars will be saved.
Representative Mulkey, before we get to the presentation, what's before the committee is really the task force and the implementation of it. You stated this is a voluntary program and some counties are already doing it. Do you know how many counties are doing it without your legislation?
Mr. Chair, at this time I'll call down Brad Trahan and he can answer that question for you.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brad Tran, Rochester, Minnesota. Currently, you should have a handout of the state of Minnesota in there. Currently, in the state of Minnesota, we have 9 counties that have implemented a program on their own. We also have one county and one agency that have sent in letters of intent, and currently in southeastern Minnesota, we have 9 other agencies that are pending, and we look for Goodhue and Wabasha and those in southeastern Minnesota by next week to have their letters of intent in.
So, I'm sorry, say your name again.
Brad Trahan.
Trahan. Mr. Trahan, could you do this without this legislation?
You know, it's difficult. With 87 counties, we're trying because we recognize the fiscal needs of what's going on, and just in Rochester 2 weeks ago, we had our official fine.
Mr. Train, there's no money now in this amendment, so my question is, could you do this without this legislation, considering now there is no funding for this? We're simply outlining a task force.
Mr. Chair and members, the reason why we're bringing forward this task force is mainly we want, as the Lifesaver programs are rolled out, we want there to be consistency in the programs that are being implemented county by county. We want there to be interoperability of the technology. We are aware that there are a couple different technologies that are out there, and they may not be interoperable, which means that if one county is sent into another county to assist in finding an individual, you would have an issue that the technologies don't match up. So that is one issue. Then the other issue is just that of obtaining private funding. But the establishment of the task force, the state patrol, and the members of the task force can look at ways to secure private sources of funding to roll out this program so that we don't have to rely upon state funds.
All right. Representative Welty or Mr. Shane, I'm going to ask one more question. We hear a lot about unfunded mandates. Should this become law, is this going to fall at some point into the unfunded mandate list that here the legislature goes again, requiring something that we didn't fund? So either Representative Welty or Mr. Trahan, you want to respond to that?
Chair Pawlowski, members, no, this is not an unfunded mandate. Because the program, as it's being rolled out, is totally voluntary, counties choose whether or not that they will opt into the program or implement it within the county. The counties know that they have to bear the cost of this.
All right, so I'm just going to make the observation that, again, it's voluntary now, and after your statement, it continues to be voluntary, but we need to pass a law to continue to make it voluntary.
Mr. Chair, members, what we want to have is coordination of this, of the implementation of this as it's rolled out into these counties when the counties choose to implement it. The other element is with the state patrol. If there is required a air search, the technology as it is right now, it's you can track on ground for up to a mile. Yes. And then after that, you can track by air up to 10 miles. The state patrol will be putting this technology in practice on a plane. And so if they're ever needed to be called in, then they will be able to provide that air service.
All right, Representative Welty, you're talking about the technology and there's no money in the bill. So how would that technology be funded since it's relatively sophisticated? Is that going to be through private donation or grant, or how does this become implemented now?
So, Mr. Chair, I will call down the colonel with the Minnesota State Patrol to discuss.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Mark Snasky, Chief Minnesota State Patrol.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The question, sir?
The question is, considering there's no funding in this bill, how would you implement the mechanism of what you're about to do without funding, since it's a rather sophisticated technology?
Mr. Chair, members, as was mentioned, the Minnesota State Patrol, as part of its mission, as part of its statutory obligation, provides support services to local law enforcement agencies when they have need, much like we're doing up in northwestern Minnesota right now for the floods. As part of that process, from time to time, we do occasionally send aircraft out to assist with searches for individuals. We've been in conversations with a number of counties in Minnesota talking about this technology. We have not purchased the equipment, but the equipment as part of our equipment obligations, part of our equipment purchases would be in Minnesota, would be a state patrol purchase, would not be part of this bill.
Well, Mr. Askey, how would you purchase it considering that we're about to launch into some of the biggest negative budgets in the history of this state?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, as I said, we're in conversations with it. We have not purchased anything. We look at this bill, and we've had conversations with the representative talking about the amount of time that we do spend with our aircraft out searching for individuals and looking at it as a viable option for reducing that amount of time.
Assuming you had the money to pay for the mechanisms to do it.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And you would not consider this bill in any way to be an unfunded mandate?
Mr. Chair, in conversations with representatives specific to the task force, the Commissioner of Public Safety and myself, as a matter of course of our business, routinely meet with the sheriffs and chiefs around the state at their conferences and regional meetings. What we propose is at those meetings, having conversations with the sheriffs and the chiefs, talking about this and establishing what's referred to as a task force to meet in conjunction with those so that there would be no other obligation associated with it other than having the conversations. And as the representative talked about, as we discuss the technology, just trying to direct it in a way so that people are aware of what the technology and the interoperability is so we don't go off in a bunch of different directions.
All right. Questions?
Yes.
President Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mansky, the testimony earlier was that the State Patrol has agreed to convene the task force. Is that accurate?
Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Minnesota State Patrol would gather the people together, at least for the first operation, try and get people together and start talking.
President Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, absent this legislation, would you still send out the letters?
Mr. Nasky.
Mr. Chair, members, I could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think when I heard you, Representative Welty, regarding the consistency and sympathetic to that, but when I hear it's voluntary opt-in and you don't have any money, it doesn't seem like it's going to take care of consistency either. This is one of those, if you really want consistency, you have to do it in 87 counties and do it the same way. this looks like an interesting study, but maybe not necessarily going to get you consistency.
Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Welty, I guess to follow up on what Representative Pawlowski mentioned earlier, Chair Pawlowski mentioned earlier, explain to me why we need state law to do this. I'm still having a hard time understanding that. Why this can't be done by the counties and by the law enforcement people working without state mandate or state statute? Why do we have to do this?
Representative Welty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwell, first of all, I believe that if we establish the task force, it does send a message to the counties as they're implementing this that we do have a task force. We recognize that this technology is being rolled out. We recognize that the task force will give guidance. And we want to ensure that there is a message sent to the counties that this issue has been discussed, it's been studied, that we have recommendations as far as what they should do when they're implementing the program and what technology may be the best technology for interoperability.
Representative Gallo.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, I'm still not hearing the answer to the question, though. Why do we need state law to do that? We can notify counties, we can coordinate, we can do a lot of things without a state task force.
Representative Welty.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwell, I believe that by putting it in state statute, it does have send a clear message that it is recognized by the state of Minnesota as a task force that gives guidance. If we were to simply continue to roll it out as it's being rolled out now, there have been other technologies that were implemented, and so we're trying to get consistency, and we believe that this guidance with this task force appointed by the state will have some bearing on the decisions that are made. And Representative Kipmeyer, could you please repeat your point? Because I know I want to make a point on that.
Representative Kipmeyer.
I think my point was mainly that if you have an opt-in voluntary and your goal is consistency, then if it's an opt-in and you're going to have in built in no consistency.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you may have a response to that, but I wasn't.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Chair Pawlowski and Representative Kipmeyer. I believe that we will have consistency under this with that task force, just as I explained to Representative Gottwald. If the State Patrol is working with this task force, and as this is being rolled out, they're having the conversations with these counties, I believe that we're going to help them and guide them into getting the technology. There have been other states, I'll just let you know, I've been in conversations with the state of Colorado. The state of Colorado, they actually have an administrator that's taking care of this within the state, so this is actually saving the state money by not hiring or putting in a part-time position for administration of a task force or grant program. So one thing is we will save money. The other is, in the state of Colorado, they found that there were issues with different technologies being implemented, and that's part of why they rolled out their program, is that they wanted consistency in the state of Colorado, and they so far are going down that path of getting more consistency.
All right, further questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. We keep talking about this technology. What is the approximate cost of this technology?
Representative Welty, do you want to respond, or do you want Mr. Trahan? Welcome back, Mr. Trahan. Do you want to answer that question?
Thank you, Chair Welty, Representative. Approximately for the startup cost for a county that does not currently have the program would be $4,000. For a county that has an existing program, the wish would be $2,000 to enhance their program. And just recently, in the search for Bruce Kennedy, who is the Minnesota man that was missing in Wisconsin, that cost that county with their agencies up to over $300,000. Recently in Rochester, we just had our official find of an 11-year-old autistic girl wandered away 2 weeks ago from her mom. They found her in 26 minutes. So it saves resources and it saves tax dollars. And it saves a life. It saves a life. I've been on a search where a boy is found dead, and it's tough.
All right, further questions? I'll renew my motion that House File 622, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Merle, House File 1378. Vice Mayor, I believe we have a division report on this. Resident Nelson, is this one of Resident
yes.
Nelson?
Yes, there was a division. There should have been a division report on it.
Do you want to move the division report?
I move the Mr. Chair, thank you. I move the division report.
All right. Resident Nelson moves the division report. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Resident Murrow, House File 1378, I'm told, has to go to finance.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So your motion would be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you have, you want to explain the bill briefly, and then you have testifiers.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are going to explain the bill very briefly. Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill for local disaster assistance. This is for disasters that fall below the FEMA threshold throughout the state. In fact, there are members seated around this table whose communities have received aid from the state to rebuild after a tornado, a flood, or other occurrence. This came to my attention when a tornado hit my district and Representative Broad's district. A house had been blown into a lake. That house remained in the lake for almost a year until the legislature came back in session in order to appropriate money to clean out the lake. What this bill would do would provide the funding directly to the Department of Public Safety and Emergency Management. And the bill sets out that the department would then allocate the funding, appropriate the funding to the disasters. I have two testifiers with me, Mr. Chair. But first, Mr. Chair, I do have an A2 amendment. The A2 amendment, Mr. Chair, and I know members are just going to be getting it. It's a short amendment. This question came up in the previous committee, Mr. Chair, to clarify some language about the emergency management provision and what a local disaster was. In order to meet that concern by a member in the previous committee, we have tried to clarify that a bit with the A2 amendment. It makes no substantive change to the legislation or to the bill, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murrow moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'll now move to Mr. Freed to introduce himself. I also have Mr. Mike Johnson here. They will briefly talk about the need for the legislation.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judge Freed. I'm the Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for Ramsey County, but I appear today representing the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. I'm past president and current legislative chair for that organization. AMEM represents more than 400 emergency managers throughout the state of Minnesota, all 87 counties, every city in the state. And we have been working with Representative Morrow to try and develop this legislation to recognize the realities of what happens in Minnesota. Right now, as you all know, Minnesotans are fighting a flood up in the northwestern part of the state, and that flood will likely result in the declaration of a presidential disaster declaration. But the threshold for that disaster declaration is fairly high. And what normally happens in Minnesota is that large numbers of disasters affect small communities that don't meet that federal declaration. It leaves the community on the hook for $50,000, $400,000, case of Hugo, $400, I believe $38,000. And in the end, they come here before you folks and ask, can we get a special appropriation for money? It takes a year plus for that to all happen. The purpose of this legislation would be to try and set up a small fund to simplify that process, to codify it a little bit so that it's not just somebody coming ad hoc to make a plea, and to get the money into the hands of those locals quicker if they suffer a disaster or an emergency that makes it impossible for them to continue to carry out the business of taking care of their citizens.
All right. Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murrow, I appreciate the intent of this. I guess I struggle with this not only from a fiscal perspective, and I realize we're not a finance committee. So $6 million aside, there are tons of questions that come up around this about what constitutes a disaster, what's going to trigger the event, mm-hmm. that accesses these funds? Is it a house in the lake? Is it a bridge collapse? Is it a tornado? Is it the term disaster could refer to a lot of things, and the dollar amounts could range anywhere from the tens or hundreds of thousands you're talking about to millions of dollars. So we're starting with $6 million. I guess I'd have a question about why the $6 million, and then what constitutes a disaster.
Rep. Simrow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Rep. Gottwald. I also, we do have Director Chris Heide from this, the Department of Emergency Management who could talk to that. We have met with the Department support the bill in part. We came up with this dollar figure by taking the average, I believe it was over the last 10 years, but I would have to turn to Director Heide to be more specific on that point. So that's the dollar amount, but it's the average that the state of Minnesota has appropriated through legislation for disasters of this type. I'll turn to the experts to describe or explain how we define disaster. This question, Representative Gottwald, did come up in the previous hearing. Mr. Freed does have a response. We tried to figure out if we could be more specific. The more specific that we got at one point, the department started to get concerned. So I'll let the department talk about that as well. But maybe first I'll allow Mr. Freed to talk about how disaster is defined in Minnesota.
Mr. Freed, Mr. Chair, Representative, The term disaster and the term emergency is defined in Minnesota law. Chapter 12, Section 12.03 does declare what that is. Further on in Chapter 12, and this legislation would be a part of Chapter 12, it goes through the entire formal process for how a community or a county would declare a disaster. And it is specified that the mayor or the chair of the county board has to go through a process of declaring this emergency. It has to be ratified later on by council. So it's not the sort of thing that's really subject to much abuse, where, you know, a single shingle fell off of a roof, I'm declaring it a disaster. I don't believe any elected official will be able to stand up to that in light of what we see happening in Moorhead today. The numbers that we went are based in part off of the federal numbers that exist. In order for a presidentially declared major disaster to occur in Minnesota, it's a per capita amount that equates to about $6.4 million. We took a look at that number, and that's across the state, and then in addition to that, there's another $3.28 of damage that has to happen in the affected county. So the numbers start to grow very, very quickly. So, you know, Hugo, for instance, had to absorb a $400,000 loss of public uninsured infrastructure, and that does not raise to the presidential disaster level. So this is for public uninsured loss. And then we took a look at what has the Homeland Security or what have representatives come in front of this body to ask for in the past and kind of average that out. That's where we came out with $6 million.
Representative
Gallo. So, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Morrow, the testifiers, if I'm understanding this correct, what we're trying to do is put into an account money that's really already being spent or accessed so that it can be accessed more readily for the disasters it's trying to help. Is that... There's already money we're spending.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, that's exactly right. Representative Gottwald, when I came to the legislature, that's when I learned that we had a legislative act brought by a representative or a senator in order to allocate money to pay for public infrastructure that had been damaged in a smaller disaster. To me, it seemed better to put this decision in the hands of the experts, the people who are on the ground, and also to obviate the need for a special session, for example, and the cost involved in order to get money to a community like Hugo or others. We have a long list of the communities that we've had to pass bills for in order to get them the assistance they needed.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Morrow, thank you for your amendment, helping me with my concern and continuing to work with me on this. I do appreciate it. To the department, I do have one question. As you greatly pointed out, the definition of a disaster in 12.03, there doesn't appear to be in this legislation any check or balance on the determination or the application of that definition. As I read lines 1.13 to 1.16 of the bill, the determination is solely made by the local unit of government. And then as I go down to 1.17 and start with the sentence, within the limits of the funds available, the state director must award the grants. And so there is no determination where the state can say out of the state coffer, you know, we don't think you meet the criteria. as long as local elected officials think they meet the criteria. According to the words on 1.18, you have to release the dollars. Am I reading that incorrectly?
Representative Merrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think that Director Ide might be best suited from the department to answer that question.
Well, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Ide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and I do want to make it clear that this bill is not in the governor's budget. We understand that, and that I am here to give technical information and not to support or oppose this bill. Mr. Chair, Representative Diskins, I understand your concern. I am also concerned with any word that is must, because a public infrastructure program like this would have to have a declaration of an emergency in the local community, and then we would have to, in order to give state resources, the governor also would declare a state of emergency for that community. Because there is no program right now, we do not have any criteria, but it would have to be that a community would be eligible in whatever criteria was developed for any kind of a public assistance program.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me here, Representative Morrow. If we put this money in this account and there is, and hopefully there is no disaster this next year that we have to pay out, what happens with this money and what is at stake?
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, this money would stay in that account waiting for the next year. But given the average, given in fact what we're seeing now, that unfortunately the likelihood is that it would be used.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate, Representative Murrow, you bringing this forward. And I think there's many, many applications where this would apply and create efficiency and speed in getting dollars out to these, a lot of smaller communities that have some huge costs right away that, even if we're in session, really need the dollars now. And I think this also would provide some bridge funding between our regular sessions. I remember 4 or 5 years ago we came back for special session. I think that was with the Roseau flood, possibly, if I remember right. And and the state's been always generous in helping these communities out, but there is immediately for these communities, and I've seen it, where there are these costs that need to be paid right now and really would make things a lot better. So I think it's great that you'd have a fund like this, and appreciate all the help with all the agencies on what's happening up in northwest Minnesota right now.
Members, this is going to finance, so just to be clear. Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrow, I'm based on my last questioning, I mean, philosophically, I'm kind of in support of this, but I am concerned about some of the looseness of the language. I understand we've got a good definition in statute of disaster, but again, that must is an issue. It mentions public infrastructure, public health, and other costs attributable. It's pretty broad, and maybe it needs to be to meet the need. But I would have much more comfort if we had some language in here that was more specific, that said, you know, here's what it can be used for, and only this. Especially as we look at the budget and adding another place to put money.
Representative Merrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, I'll continue to work with the department. This is language I've run by the department. Tried to talk about amendments that might have been made this more specific. There was concern on that, and I've been working with the emergency management folks around the state to try to figure out a way that empowers the department to get the funds quickly to the disaster site. But I'll certainly take those in mind. And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your reminder that the fiscal situation I'll talk about in the Finance Committee.
And Representative Merrill, also as a reminder, when we did have the floods in southern Minnesota, we passed special legislation and subsequently an entire detailed disaster response, and one of the key words was flexibility, because a tornado is not a flood, and the difference between the two are great, and when these things occur, nobody can anticipate really what happens. And with infrastructure in particular, you need to be sure that we can respond. Communities need to be put back together. So, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually could probably go to Ms. Idy or Representative Morrow. In lines 1.15 and 1.16, it says that the state director has to provide forms and procedures and timelines. The commissioner needs to do that. Do you know what the rulemaking requirement might be for that? Because it strikes me that rulemaking might be the best way of providing both criteria and flexibility for the department in establishing guidelines, criteria, etc. So I don't know if this language does that or could do that or should do that.
Ms. Idy? Or Director Idy, I'm sorry.
Director. Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, whether it's through rulemaking or through guidance and management documents, we could work with either. I think from our experience that we would, if this fund were to be established and a program established, we would like to reflect the FEMA criteria in a lot of this. Our folks are, as you know, very busy in the field trying to assess the damage at the same time they're trying to recover. And so we would be using a lot of the same forms and a lot of the same criteria for eligibility of repairs.
Mr. Chair, my comment, I guess, would be that this could be very beneficial in the sense of establishing some neutral criteria or definition for what qualifies, because when we do it through the legislature, of course, it becomes a lot of it a battle of who's good at bringing resources home to their local community. And the definition of disaster depends on maybe the committee that you chair or the seniority that you have or your support from your caucus or other things in part. Now, of course, we all want to help, but there are degrees. And so I think having an agency that's expert in this, establishing some better definitions might be one of the beneficial results of this if it's done in a deliberate manner.
Representative Kitzmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can see a lot of value in what you're bringing forward. I think it's not a matter if, it's a matter of how. Excuse me. So I think the main thing here is structuring it in a way. And I do also, in any other state level, I mean, a local government, basically by their say-so, can expend state funds. And so usually when you have a grant situation, you have state money, you have an application for that grant, and then you have an entity such as, in this case, the Department of Public Safety, would be able to approve that grant. So you kind of have that built in there. This way, it's a must, and you don't even have some of the framework. And so I like the idea and the concept. I think there's a lot of value, and I've heard a lot of good things about it. But I think it's more how it's structured, and I'm concerned that we move forward now. This is the place sometimes, this is the policy body where we're not dealing with the money. We are dealing with the how and the policy, and I think it should be dealt with here if this were to go forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kittmeyer, I want to make sure I'm clear about turning to the experts. My understanding of the word must on line 1.14 is that the locality must make the declaration. It's not that the state must fund, but rather the locality must declare. Now, I may...
1.18.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, 1.18 is what they were.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Gottwald. And I think I will turn to the folks here on 1.18.
Director Idy or...
Mr. Chair, I would also recommend that we change that word month.
And what would you suggest we change it to?
May.
Representative Murray, you want to make
that
motion?
Mr. Chair, I will move to amend 1.18 to delete the word must and insert the word may.
All right, let's wait a second here to make sure it works. And that's the only spot that we need to make that change. Section, do you have it?
Yes.
And can you get that to us in writing?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I realize that it's a small change, but periodically small changes that have been done in what we loosely refer to as verbal or oral amendments sometimes get confusing, particularly when they don't appear in the minutes. So we'll make sure it appears in the minutes the way Representative Murrell wishes it to appear. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that is a very constructive word change here, but it deals with one part of it. but it doesn't deal with the other part, which is, you know, the criteria and some of those structural things as far as by what discretion will this state director what's the discretion, what's the authority, what's the process there? And I think the director has already spoken to some things that would be beneficial.
Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think I would return back to Representative Winkler's apt comment that in hearing Director Ivey talked about preparing guidelines and criteria that most closely follow, if not mirror, the type of theme of the guidelines. I'd much rather give them the flexibility to determine what the guidelines would be. I don't think they should be in statute, and for that reason, I'm comfortable leaving the language as is. But I do hear what you're saying, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Members, we have four more bills on the agenda. Caucuses are at 10, and sessions at 10:30 as a reminder to individuals. And with that reminder, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to briefly point out that, Mr. Chair, your bill, the framework last year, the work that Representative Winkler did in response to the 35W bridge and setting up the catastrophe framework, and this bill, as well as the kind of catches up to the good work that the department and our local folks have been doing on emergency management. I think that it represents a real significant step forward in preparing, not just responding. And I want to thank you, Representative Morrow, for following up on the work that the chair has done before.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Morrow.
I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
As amended, that House File 1378 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Junkie was here. There he is. Representative Junkie. Members, there is a memo dealing with the contents of Representative Junkie's bill that is before the committee. Representative Junkie, I will move that House File 1367 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. And Representative Junkie, why don't you go to those sections of the bill that specifically are before us?
The first I've seen your memo, but...
I believe Section 13, page 3, expansion of rulemaking authority of the Commission, so Section 13, page 3. Or why don't we have Mr. Shepard? Why don't we have Mr. Shepard walk through those sections, Representative Junkie, and then if you want to respond as to why they're in the bill, and then we'll have discussion. So, Mr. Shepard,
Mr. Chair, members, on the bottom of page 3, section 13, line 31, changes a reference so that the commissioner's rulemaking authority will apply to some new sections that are included at the end of this bill, as sections 25 to 27, the grant program. And then the other part that is within the jurisdiction of the committee is beginning on page 12, line 35, which is the noxious weed advisory, or actually, I'm sorry, it's on page 13, the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee.
Then, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. The rulemaking authority is tied into a new fund that's created in the Department of Agriculture to receive monies for the Noxious Weed Program. In particular, federal monies come in, but we can also receive funds from non-state resources. So they have to put together, in the Rural Finance Authority, some rules on handling that account and that money. So that new section was added here to set up that fund. And that's why the rules, I assume, were changed so that he can propagate rules to handle those funds. The main section, obviously, that you're concerned with, too, is the advisory committee. There's an advisory committee established. They have to meet at least every 3 years, with the exception of when this takes effect. They need to meet and recommend back within the first year for the new noxious weed list. This was a task force that was formed a couple of years ago, and this whole bill is a result of a rewrite of the noxious weed rules that govern Minnesota noxious weed law. And I have a number of the task force members here, as well as the department, if you have any questions.
And then the advisory committee is paid per diem? And
No,
they are not?
No.
All right. And could the advisory committee meet without this bill?
Probably not.
why didn't they represent
it? The commissioner is the overseer of the noxious weed rule, the way that this bill is put forth, and there's some changes for county government and how they administer noxious weed rules, too. But the commissioner in this bill becomes the ultimate overseer and is responsible for convening this task force of specialists to upgrade the noxious weed list. I don't know where they would do this ad hoc without a call of the commissioner.
Representative Junkie, that's my point. The commissioner could do it on his or her own without this, but we would have to tell them to do it. Is that
we're telling them which Representative Kowalski, we're telling them which members to call when they're doing this, and that was the result of the task force. What group? Nursery associate. I mean, there's groups that specialize in different weed species and different concerns as far as noxious weeds. We want to make sure they're in the room as we redo these lists every 3 years.
All right. Any further discussion? Representative Junkie, I'm sorry, Representative Stern.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Junkie. I'm just wondering, does this bill take away the authority of the city's weed inspectors?
Representative Junkie.
Mr. Chair, a brief discussion on how noxious weed law works, and we'll continue to work in here. Local authorities, cities and townships have responsibility for noxious weed inspections and issuing control orders upon inspection. That's how it's always been. What this does is establish, well, that doesn't change. From that point, if a city or a township doesn't do it and a complaint comes in from a citizen, they then go to the next level, which is the county, which ultimately has oversight, and this lays out a way that the county then can fulfill their role as the check agency, if you will, on that local municipality. But no, it does, your local city and townships are the ones that are responsible and remain responsible for the main noxious weed law. Thank you.
Mr.
Chairman and Representative Junkie, I'm glad to see you've got at least two pro-weed people on this group of list. Yes.
I believe Representative Kahn has a particular type of gardening that's loosely called thug gardening. She promotes weeds. Representative Junkie, do you have anyone that wishes to testify for or against the bill of
pleas? Unless you have questions that I can't answer.
I think that we've got the questions out that we need. All
this
right.
Will be going to finance, Mr. Chair. It will be in our omnibus agriculture and veterans bill.
All right. All those in favor of House File 1367 be recommended to pass and be referred to finance, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There he is. Representative Western.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'd like to move the committee report.
Representative Nelson moves the committee, the division report. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, you want to make a motion on House File 1501? I believe General Register is where it goes.
Sure, I'd like to move that the House File 1501 be recommended to pass and move to that General Register.
All right, with that motion, Representative Westrum, the bill's before us. Do you want to tell us what it says?
I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for making time for this bill. Representative Nelson heard it in the committee. This bill deals with a sewer district that in 2003 the legislature gave permission to six townships that by resolution create, if they so chose. To fast forward, that district proceeded ahead with working on a centralized sewer system. In the past year, Representative Otremba and myself and Senator Ingebrigtsen, who is our senator, but Representative Otremba and I share a border with the district being about half in each of our districts. The residents became very concerned and vocal.
Oh. Representative Otremba, welcome to the committee.
I'll just finish briefly, and then Representative Trumbull may have some comments. But the long story short, the residents wanted the townships to opt out or get out of this district. As we got looking at it with House Research, there wasn't a good procedure necessarily spelled out, and this would give them some options as township officials as to how they're going to levy back some of the $3 million costs that have been incurred by the district with planning and other expenses as a land purchase and other things, and how they're going to get rid of their assets. And so this would give them a more clear way of doing that with a couple different options. Otherwise, all they have is the ad valorem tax, and many have said they don't think just an ad valorem tax is a fair way to disband it, and so this would allow a special charge where under law special assessments they could be challenged, and because people did not receive a benefit to their property per se. So with that, Representative
Let's come to chamber briefly then to the bill.
I'm just here for support.
Moral support, and it's greatly appreciated. Any questions? Any questions? Anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? All right. Seeing none, then Representative Nelson.
I'll renew my motion.
He renews his motion that House File 1501 be recommended to pass to be placed in the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails.
Thank you so much.
Members, House File 2146, I'm going to ask the commissioner to come down. He's been very patient. I'm going to move House File 2146 be recommended to pass and to be referred to the Finance Committee. This is an ongoing series of issues we've had combining two departments, which we started last year and we're in the final stages of. So, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and explain why we need 2146.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, I'm Tom Hansen. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Finance, Representative Khan, and hope to be the Department of Management and Budget. This bill, and by the way, I'm not sure we're following noxious weeds and sewage on your agenda. I don't know what that says about our bill, but I'll try and defend it as best I can. Reorganization Order 195 transferred the Management Analysis Division from the Department of Administration to the Department of Finance effective August 20th, 2008, this last summer. This proposal would codify that transfer. MAT is a natural fit with the newly combined department and its focus on enterprise-wide service to all state agencies. Our new mission statement is to increase state government's capacity to manage and utilize financial, human, information, and analytical resources to ensure exceptional service and value for Minnesota's citizens is based directly on MAD's mission as well. The language looks a lot more complex than it is. It basically transfers MAD references from the Department of Administration to the Department of Finance statutes and clarifies the internal service funds the department currently reviews.
All right. And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. And
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Bill Slossing. I'm Director of Management and Health.
And do you wish to testify or just answer questions?
Mr. Chairman, it's here for questions.
All right. Any questions? This is going to finance, members. Any questions? Seeing no questions, then I'll renew my motion that House File 2146 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Gunther was here. There he is. Representative Gunther, I believe this goes to finance.
Mr. Chairman,
at least that's what we've been instructed.
This bill at 4 o'clock today.
Pardon?
Representative Eakin from Environment Policy would like to hear this bill at 4 o'clock today.
So you want us to send it to Environment Policy?
That's where he was.
All right.
That's where he wants to hear it.
If that's Get where it has to go, we will send it to, I will recommend that House File 2132 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Environment Policy. Representative Gunther, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is part of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. It does certain things for travel and constitutes a meeting. Basically, the purpose of the bill will bring the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council administrative structure into compliance with Minnesota Constitution. And it also solves, is a solution applies to travel funding by the Outdoor Heritage Council and other things. And we have Bill Becker here to help answer any questions you have. I know you're strapped for time, so we certainly entertain any questions.
All right, Rev. Gunther, we may just be on the money here, depending on how long. Inspector, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chair, I am Bill Becker. I'm the Acting Executive Director for the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council.
And you want anything you wish to say about the bill?
We'd like to amend it.
I think we need to get the bill in order, Mr. Chair.
Do you have an amendment, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have the A090275 amendment.
I will move that amendment, and why don't you explain the amendment before we put it on, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, this allows travel to and from site visits by members of the council paid for the administrative funds appropriated from the Outdoor Heritage Fund in fiscal years 10 and 11 and are not meetings of the council for the purpose of receiving information under Minnesota statute section 97A.056, subdivision 5.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Gunther.
Members, this basically talks about the makeup of the council and suspending the open meeting law requirements while in travel status. We're going to take a bus and see various sites that want to be considered for the next year's allocations, and that basically is the sum and total of the bill. Chairman.
Right. Representative Gunther, you want to go into a little more detail here on the suspension of the open meeting law and why that's needed?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Spector.
Thank you. The statutes creating the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council define a meeting of the council as a gathering of the quorum to make decisions or to gather information. One of the typical things that is done with a council like this is to travel to site visits to see works that have improved natural resources and things of that sort. And to investigate programs that provide conservation. Generally, it is to the advantage of the council and the state to allow natural resource professionals to provide information while traveling so that the tours can be more efficient and go a little bit quicker, and we can get information back and forth between council members and the resource professionals. So this amendment is asking the ability to do that kind of information gathering. It does not allow the council to make any decisions, hold any votes, or anything like that while traveling. The ramification of not doing this is either we would have to allow the public on the vehicle, which could become a problem from a liability standpoint, or we would have to divide the council into two or three vehicles in order to comply with the open meeting law, as we understand it.
All right. I've got several people who wish to comment. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say I have concerns about this proposal, and I have to, from the outset, tell you that I'm not one who's on the environmental committee, so maybe I'm at a disadvantage there, and others who are can educate me if I'm off base here. But this looks to me, as it's been put by others, like a little bit of empire building here. We've got the DNR that's already taken care of the staffing. This is supposed to be a legislative commission, so we've got the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And now we want this group to have its own authority to hire its own staff, and now we're growing another agency and giving more autonomy. And I have to tell you, just personally, based on what I've read, I don't like some of what's going on at the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council in the way that it's treating some people. And I'll just bring out the example of the real tremendous beating that Representative Hansen, I think quite unfairly, has received at the hands of some members there, particularly some of the citizen members. And I'm not in any mood to give this group its own independent authority to hire when it already has others hiring for it and others with whom it's working. This is creating a bureaucratic empire unto itself. I think it's a bad idea.
Representative Tom.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have two questions. One, I don't understand this amendment because legislative committees do this all the time. The LCMR, which I was a member of, certainly did this, and we certainly never needed any kind of a release from the outdoor from the Open Meeting Act. So I don't understand why this one did. And I have another question, which probably can't be answered today. Is there any place in state statute other than in a title where the name of a living person is included in, as an element of state government? That's a question
I,
to
I
be...
I can refer it to Mr. Shepard, but I, unless one of the two gentlemen up front wish to tackle that one. No. Mr. Shepard or Ms. Dyson, you have a response?
Mr. Chair, members, on both points, on Representative Kahn's first point, the reason the old Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources was different is because they're subject to a different open meeting law that provides that a meeting occurs only when action is taken. Okay. Under the law that this group is subject to, a meeting occurs when they receive information. And so, and the only other example I'm aware of in law of a living person being referred to is that there's a Doug Johnson, one of the laws governing one of the funds under the IRRRB is named after former Senator Douglas Johnson. I believe.
President Kahn, that's as
okay.
good
yes.
as we can do.
Representative
Kalin, I believe, has an amendment, the HRD amendment. Representative Kalin, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the one-line amendment. Thank you, Mr. Shepard, for writing it up. I think to the structural question that Representative Simon raised, I appreciate the work that the council is doing in the advisory role, and I... was a co-author on the bill to establish the amendment, to put it on the ballot, and worked with former Representative Moe on crafting some of the council language. And I want to make sure that I think the legitimate concerns that Representative Simon has raised are held throughout the state. And I think from an efficiency perspective, I know this is not a new issue and a new approach here, but I think that it is appropriate for it to go through the LCC. I do have some concern about the 1% allocation, too, and I know that's also not a new issue. I just wanted to raise that as well and let you know I'm not including that in the amendments, but I do believe that the LCC is probably the appropriate place to do the hiring, and it saves the council from having to go through constitutional questions of spinning off into a fourth branch, which I don't think was the intent. So with that, I move the HRD 928 AM amendment.
All right. He's moved the amendment. Representative Kahn.
I certainly will accept this amendment. I think it's fine.
Well, we'll vote on it first, but that's okay. Any further discussion
no
to the amendment? Mr. Becker, do you want to?
No, sir.
All right. No, seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion to the bill as amended. No further discussion. Then I'll renew my motion that House File 2132, as amended, be passed and be re-referred to the Environment Policy and Oversight Committee. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Poppy.
I'd like to move the minutes of Wednesday, March 25th.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.